Ladies and gentlemen, it's 1 o'clock. It's the Stanford's Travel Writers Festival. Please welcome to the stage John McCarthy and Kate A.D.
Hello.
Gosh.
Wow. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honour to be here, and a fantastic honour for me to be here with Kate, who I admire, and I know all you do too. But also, I feel a bit of a fraud being at a travel show when I'm probably still best known for going nowhere for years on end when I was banged up in Beirut. But we'll touch on that. But we're here to talk about perhaps, obviously, experiences in the Middle East, particularly on Kate's, but also her extraordinary travels all around the globe, covering dangerous situations and not so dangerous situations sometimes, and likewise touching on some of my own experiences. But a question I wanted to ask you, Kate, to start with. I know that many moons ago, before you even became a journalist, you studied Scandinavian studies and the sagas and stuff. Did you explore Scandinavia as a student? Was that your first experiences outside the UK?
Oh, my professor looked at me and he said, you come from the northeast of England, he said. Therefore, he said, clearly exposed at birth on a cliff face. Therefore, of the four jobs for the four people in my honours year at university, he said, the others are going to Stockholm and to Lund. He said, you're going to the Arctic Circle. So I found myself in the subarctic circle, to be precise, 55 miles south of the actual line, teaching English peripatetically across 8 schools. A, I'd never taught. B, winter came very soon after I got there, and I had to ski to school, which everybody says, marvelous. Think of the money that you folks are paying to go skiing. I had to. Except that I had to sort of ski along by the side of main roads near being killed by snow plows coming along. And I was very, very slow. It was all cross country. And there is nothing more humiliating than your 10-year-olds going past going, moron fricken, going slowly, aren't we? You know? So I did that extraordinary year, experienced a place where at 9 o'clock in the morning, somewhere into the sort of second lesson, there used to be a tiny little glimmer on the horizon, a sort of orange little, like a light bulb, daytime. It was there for 8 minutes and then went.
Wow.
It's an extraordinary experience. But if you go into the other side of it, the great white nights and 24 hours daylight, the wonderful thing is, and think of this if you ever plan to go right up there, and particularly in the summer, Lapland, through Sweden, Norway, Finland, you didn't really need to go to bed. Everybody works. Your body adapts, and you need about 2 hours snooze.
Oh, really?
And it's wonderful. You say to people at 3 a.m, where shall we go? You rarely get that chance. So, I mean, I got a taste of other places when I was a student.
And as a journalist, what was the first time you headed off? Obviously, you worked in the UK, and then you made a breakthrough with that amazing reporting at the time of the Iranian embassy siege, as a fairly novice, I suppose, reporter. But then you were off and around the world, making your name, I suppose, covering the
very first story I did, foreign story. You know, and I was watching fellow reporters go off to, I don't know, Southeast Asia and Angola and America. And they said, you're going to Holland. A bit sort of, and they said, and we're finding the cheapest way, you're going by ferry. Which was hardly the red-hot story I thought I was going to do. More than that, they sort of said, it's about a group of evangelical religious people. In a nutshell, the story was, and this is many, many decades ago, that a small religious group wouldn't take vaccination in Northern Holland, and there was an outbreak of polio. It was quite staggering. We went into Utrecht Hospital, I remember, and there was a child in an iron lung, something which had gone from the rest of Europe. There was a huge argument about whether these people should be made to be vaccinated because of the worry of going into the rest of... Anyway, we went to film them. You'd think this is the quiet story. There were people in the war in Angola, my colleagues, having a heck of a time, and they were elsewhere fighting terrorism. And I was sent off to Holland. And we were stood there very, very quietly and discreetly about 100 yards from this church on the Sunday morning where these people arrived dressed rather like the Amish are. And we were concentrating, as you do, me standing next to the cameraman, when we heard a noise and somebody drove a car right at us.
Wow.
Very religious people they were. I was very surprised to see they approved of cars and drove them at people. And so in my first story, I ended up totally in a ditch. All three of us in a ditch as this car went past and was going to hit us.
A sign of things to come. Because my first experience of working as a journalist overseas was going to a war zone. But as a completely naive young man, I was excited. I worked for a television news agency in London. And the Lebanese civil war had been going, this was in 1986, had already been going for 10 years, as you know, you'd been covering it already. And I thought, this is going to be fantastic for my career, it's going to be fascinating. And I thought, having worked in a news agency where we saw hours and hours of film and video rushes coming in of the devastation, particularly from Beirut, I thought it'll be sort of familiar. But what was extraordinary, going into that bombed out city, Beirut, for the first time, was realizing that, of course, it's not on a TV screen. It's everywhere. All the buildings were totally shot up and damaged.
And television doesn't tell you what it smells like.
No, exactly. And more importantly, television doesn't tell you, because normally the stories would be covering the aftermath of a bomb attack or a big political event or a shooting, covering a war. Perhaps your own reports would be that. They don't normally cover what it's like when the shooting stopped and the people come back on the streets, the ordinary life of citizens of the war zone. And that was fascinating to see, to begin to appreciate the resilience of civilians.
You do see real... Well, I remember flying in on the wonderful Middle East Airlines, which, you know, are completely crazy pilots, the only people who would fly into their home country. And the cabin crew... came down the aisle as we were sort of on, not so much on approach as coming in like that, which was quite terrifying. They say it'd be busy in Beirut tonight, you know. There was stuff coming up. We're in this big, heavy, slow airliner, and the crew are coming up, and are they saying, you know, fasten your seat? They're saying very solicitously, he's maybe trouble. When you have time, you will have time. Here is card for restaurant my cousin has. You know, and they were giving out sort of business cards of mates and things, saying, don't worry, they are very nice people in Beirut. And if you ever want to buy antiques, here is another guy. You know, but we're going into a war zone.
But it's extraordinary, that feeling. I mean, perhaps you found that in other places. Because I know as soon as I arrived and I met my colleagues and started getting to know these people who I was meant to be there for a month, and I was there working for a month, and then obviously I ended up staying rather longer. And this was, because it's funny, I guess our paths sort of crossed in a way, because this was the spring of 1986, and I think you were covering the bombing of Tripoli by American warplanes against Gaddafi, and it was probably, that was might have been one of the reasons that they started picking up more Westerners across the Mediterranean in Lebanon, and of course I was one of them.
Yeah. I mean, the place at the time, everybody was frightened about kidnapping. I did two big kidnap stories, in a sense, or at least hostage-taking, in Libya as well. They were bizarre. What you could say about Beirut is at least it sort of ran along conventional lines and they had reasons for doing it. In Libya, which was a country that wasn't quite in the land of sanity, you got the oddest behavior. And one of the four British people who had been taken by these Gaddafi young revolutionary guards, the usual internal trouble, which Gaddafi himself, he had nothing to do with, but he'd started it all. One of these groups decided to lift various foreigners, which included a Brit who, when I said, you know, was he, you know, in the oil fields or was he considered being a spy? They say, no, he is piano player at Al Kabir Hotel. And I said, why was he lifted? Don't know, probably terrible piano player. you get into these very strange situations. But the thing you're looking for all the time, especially when there's crisis, when there's trouble, when there's violence, you're looking for ordinary folks who've got a sort of common sense approach to life and haven't lost their wits. And you will find loads of them. Even in the worst of situation, there are people who will say, this is terrible. You know, I remember in places like Sarajevo, we have got a shell hit in this area this morning. And you said, what area? They said, my living room. And you go to their house and they say, not a problem. The kitchen, amazing. I can make fire. I will give you a cup of tea. And I will talk about it. People who have got common sense, feet on the ground, cope. And you find that everywhere. And that's the magic thing amongst gun-toting lunatics. You still have people. Did you ever find that when you were...
Well, I remember one of the first people I met in Lebanon was actually a Palestinian guy who I worked with. And his name was Hassan. And he used to pay his parking fines, which was so sweet, because everybody in Beirut, as indeed much of the Middle East, it seems to me, drives at 100 miles an hour regardless, and on any side of the road. And the idea that you would pay a parking fine in a city that was devastated through from a decade of civil war, I thought was absolutely sweet. And he said, no, I believe that one day we will have a society back. So I am trying, that's my little bit about keeping it going. So I'll go to the office, which nobody else would do, the bureau of whatever it was, and pay my parking fine. But he used to sometimes say when we saw coverage of the aftermath of a fight or whatever, he would just look at me with sort of sadness, but a kind of an understanding, profound understanding, particularly perhaps, you know, being a Palestinian and knowing the background of his own people from Palestine and Israel. He would just look at me and say, John, this is not a way. And he was so right. And he was trying to live his life and in a world which would come back. And I guess that's something perhaps you've seen in other parts. I mean, obviously, you've covered wars in the Middle East. But
One of our interpreters, because when you're working in a lot of countries, you do need interpreters. And there's a whole backstory to how you choose them, how they come and find you. Because you mustn't have someone who is very obviously party pre to one side, someone who changes the words and misinterprets, gives it a slant. You know, and with a purpose, etc. So what was very common in a place like Bosnia, a modern European country, and good teaching standards before the war, was that a lot of the students had good English and were very eager, and they were the more sophisticated Sarajevans who really didn't cleave to the Serb-Bosnian-Croat identity. They were a generation on from that, but they were the minority and the city dwellers. And we had several people interpret over the years. And my favorite was Yasmina. And Yasmina came to us as a 19-year-old student who was a medical student at the local hospital and the medical teaching unit. And she was about a year and a half into her studies when everything broke out. And she found herself doing a little bit of study with the few lectures that remained, because the whole university, a lot of lecturers left, some were killed, places were bombed out, no electricity, that sort of thing, in this chaotic city. And she used to go for a lecture, but normally, this is after 1.5 years of being a student, be told, no, on the wards today. So wow. She put on a little white coat and say, I hope they don't ask me questions. And she'd carry a book to try and recognize various things, because she'd only done a year's study, but she was needed because of the desperate situation. So she did her medical training practically in every way. So she'd do that in the evening after she'd done 8 hours with us during the daytime filming and interpreting. And she'd come off at about 1 a.m. off the wards, and we'd said, Yasmina, where did you sleep last night? I am not sleep. I have met new boyfriend. There is wonderful club held in this cellar. Nice boy. I not miss a chance. She went out dancing. At about 6 a.m, she'd turn up and say, another day's work? She's a fantastic girl. I have to say now, she's a qualified pediatrician. She's a brilliant woman. And the whole thing was, she said, with all her peer group, There will be a time after the war. We will be needed. We have to go on studying. Fantastic people. And you meet them in the course of reporting on explosions and kidnappings and everything else. There are these amazing people keeping going.
I met a very interesting guy in China. This was three or four years ago, and I was making a film. It was a lovely project, not covering a war at all, about the art and architecture of the Far East. And our guide and our translator had lived in England. His English was perfect. And he'd married an English woman. And he was clearly incredibly anti the Chinese regimes, governments, solicitors, for all that it was claiming to modernize and open up the economy, etc., and claim, you know, the kudos for that. He was saying, no, they're holding us back. Without the Communist Party, we'd be far, far wealthier, etc., etc. So I assumed that he was just absolutely anti the Chinese establishment. And at one point, we were filming in Tiananmen Square, where, of course, you famously filmed the extraordinary incidents there years before. And inevitably, with the camera there, the guards in their military uniforms were striding up and asking and stuff. And he kept very dismissively just saying, off, let's go away, whatever it was in Chinese. And I said, you know, you're looking like you're being quite aggressive with these people. Is that wise? Because, you know, we could just get bundled away. And he said, yes, you're right. I must be more polite. And I said, well, why are you being rude? I know you don't like them, but it's a bit daft, isn't it? And he said, well, I haven't told you this, but my father was one of Chairman Mao's right-hand men at the time of the revolution. He was on the Long March. He, when I was a little boy, he was governing, and God knows how he was doing, but with brute force, no doubt, one of the western provinces of China. So my mother and I, we lived like royalty here in Beijing. And so I grew up thinking that everybody was just a kind of servant. So it's an extraordinary feeling that you know, this idea he was a kind of a red prince, if you like. And he hadn't quite lost that, despite the fact that he'd utterly rejected Chairman Mao and indeed his father's own political heritage. But it was a fascinating insight into how these things work and how societies move on.
Just before the Tiananmen massacre happened, we had several people, because there had been 3.5 months of demonstrations in 1989, prior to the actual army moving in, the BBC, along with all the other journalists there, had tried to gather in people who could give them some kind of background and advice. You try and route around, even if you're doing short news bulletins, you still need to say, why are the Politburo, which is opaque, trying to read the runes in China is a near impossibility even today. You don't know who elects, you know, gets to power. You don't know their backstory. You know nothing about them. So you try and find people who might know something. And we came across the most delightful and fascinating man who was quite elderly. He was in his... I say elderly. I was about to actually describe someone my age, yes.
Looking back, people are much younger, I found.
And he had been one of the senior generals in the People's Liberation Army. And he was an extremely intellectually smart guy. And he had been given the privileged job when China, back in the 60s in particular, had been putting out a few feelers to the rest of the world and liked to know a little bit, even under Mao, about how things were. People went as military attachés to various embassies. He was sent as a military attaché with a bigger brief to a country where they were selling lots of Chinese military equipment. And he came back from his 3 years there. And he was sat at a very, very pivotal meeting where they'd called him in, where there was tension with the West. It was all getting to one of those nasty moments where somebody might make a mistake. And the European and Americans were making certain demands. And Mao was banging the table, etc. And the general was sat there a bit nervous and was suddenly asked, what chance do we have against Europe? And the general said, piece of cake. Chinese army, huge, marvelously disciplined. And we have aircraft, no problem. And people, poor, stupid, got nothing. He had spent 3 years in Albania under Enver Hoxha.
Oh, my God.
And his entire grasp of Europe was the poorest country in Europe under a vicious dictatorship where people were bullied, brainwashed, and shot, one of the worst regimes of the post-war era. And he calmly informed the Chinese they'd have no problem with Europe whatsoever. And you think, that's bizarre, but it's true for the time. And it's these little vignettes which you get by somebody sitting having a glass of brandy late at night in Beijing. You get this sort of backstory and you think, what an amazing place. Yeah. What a bizarre bit of travel information.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, when sitting in an underground cell when I had been kidnapped in Lebanon, initially thinking all I want to do, obviously actually thinking for 5 years, all I want to do is get back to Middle England and home and my parents and girlfriend, etc. But at the same time, for a few months, I had a book by Freya Stark, the great traveller from the 1930s, who particularly travelled to the Middle East, all over the place. And reading that, I thought, there's another world, not just this terrifying world that I'm literally a tiny little part of, frightened, chained up underground, of this beautiful area. And I thought, I do want to come back to it. Not necessarily, obviously, to war-torn Beirut, as it was always called, but to explore it more. And have been able to since. And in fact, I've, you know, since peace descended on Lebanon and I'm a free man again, have been back to that little, tiny little country many times. And indeed, Israel-Palestine, also tiny areas, many times since then, and discover so much more. And it's fascinating, that story of basing your understanding of Europe on being posted to Albania. But it's interesting how one can go back to places and see more and more of them and learn more and more. And I wondered, perhaps with yourself, often you will have been sort of, quotes, parachuted into some places, but presumably you will have returned again and again, covering wars?
Yeah, some places you do find yourself going back to, some places not, purely because the story doesn't arise again. And the really frightening thing is to go back there many years later, and it has changed so much because you're used to burnt-out buildings, driving up one-way streets the wrong way, no electricity. The place... Once you suddenly start get a country back on its feet, it doesn't change its character, but it's put new makeup on. Yeah. And so that's what you see first when you encounter the country. And then you find the people haven't changed a lot. But I think particularly with the Middle East, what a lot of people who have traveled, and I know a lot of people here are well traveled, one of the things that you will probably, sadly, have to bear in mind is what most of the Eastern Mediterranean looked like. Syria, Aleppo, parts of Iraq, Libya, which all of that area now is in a terrible state. And some of the great things people went to see, the temples and the Roman ruins, right around the area, and more ancient ruins of Babylon, etc., all of this may be in your traveler's memories, and it's frightening to think what it will look like if things go on as they do. I'm not saying this should be that you shouldn't travel, but I can see the value of travel, and even just being a tourist going briefly to a place saying, I do know what it looked like, and it was marvelous. Mm. Because the horrific things happening now, I walked through here wondering just how many opportunities there were to travel to these areas now. I mean, they're all of the official things which say don't go there. But, you know, many people decide, you know, they will take their own risks, or they don't want to go to a war, but they will go to a place which is deemed difficult. And it is important to go to these places, to see them.
Well, I think it is, because also, particularly places in the Middle East, those ancient historical sites like Palmyra, which has obviously been destroyed now. And I went to Syria once on a journalistic job and thought, I'll be coming back soon and I'll get to go and see those great sites like Crac de Chevalier, Palmyra, and never did. And now they've gone, or blown to smithereens. But it would be interesting, are many people planning journeys to the Middle East at the moment, or any anyway. It'd just be interesting to know if anybody's, if it's happening. Mm. No.
I know it's difficult. I can only recommend that at the start of the first Gulf War, I ended up in Aqaba doing stories about refugees. And we got stuck there, and we were trying to get home home back to Amman rather late. And I realized we're not going to make it to Amman. So I looking at the map and I was driving, I said, good Lord, there is a town on the way, on the road. It's Petra. We were the only people in the hotel. And the next morning, the radio reporter and I hired a pair of horses and did our Indiana Jones gallop. And there was no one there. I mean, it was the biggest privilege you could have. No tourists, no guides, no touts, no. It was magical. But that's not entirely an excuse for going to a war zone. But it is the occasional magic thing happens like that. And Libya, when very few people went as tourists, I've crawled all over Leptis Magna, which is one of the great Roman sites. Yeah. And pray heaven it stays that way. It's a fabulous place. But that's not a recommendation to go to war.
No. I went to Petra, funnily enough, just this past year. I went on a cruise ship and joined the ship in Dubai, and then I got off at Aqaba for reasons I needed to get back. I think it carried on through the Suez Canal, the ship, I guess, but dodging most of, certainly, the Eastern Med and going straight up to Turkey or wherever, I think, at that point. Whether it would do that now, I don't know. But it was fascinating, because I realised that as we went down from Dubai and then round, we had Yemen on one side of us, which was beginning to blow up big time, and Somalia across on the other side of that sea, and realised that we were on this sort of glorious, luxurious cruise, admittedly with armed marines or whatever on board, going through, dressing up in our dinner jackets for evening meals, whilst the rest of the world was in chaos. Yeah. But I remember interviewing P.J. O'Rourke once, the American journalist, and he said that he was in Egypt, and he said it was brilliant. He was laughing at himself in a way. He said because he got to see the pyramids at Giza. Now it's probably the similar situation. I was there a year or so ago, and there's no tourists there, so you almost get attacked by the guys who are the tourist guides. But he said he was let in, and he could wander around those extraordinary ruins by moonlight with a local guard who he just gave a couple of dollars to.
What is quite extraordinary. I mean, the last 40 years, I mean, my parents hardly travelled at all until later in their lives. They'd been through the war, and they had to grab their opportunities when they were much older. My generation hopped on trains when we were 17 and interrailed through Europe and went to exciting places. I went to Berlin when the wall was up, when I was a student in Berlin. I was just absolutely gripped by it. And I got used to the business of cheap travel, grab your timetable and stay anywhere that didn't have too many fleas. And I went all over Europe, went to Russia, and then started. These days, young people go much further. I'll have you backpacked around Peru. Oh, yes, very good. You know, it's amazing where people can get these days, and everybody is adventurous. And to discover, as in the last 2 years, that a very large chunk of the places you'd like to go, Aleppo, Palmyra, Egypt, these important places, fabulous history, wonderful cuisine, all of this, and suddenly you're actually right up against it. And by that I mean anybody who's going in the next few months to Greece is going to see history happen. There are hundreds of thousands who are waiting ready to try and get across to the Greek islands. If you are in southern Turkey, you're going to see these camps. In what we call our standard tourism, the world's difficulties are coming right to the doorstep at the moment of happy travel, curious, informed travel to wonderful places. And it's going to be quite something to cope with, because when you travel very much hoping that it will be a very positive experience. It's going to be quite difficult, I suspect, for a year or two to come. And people are going to have to gird their loins. Though the other phrase is, you are seeing history happen, which may or may not be a blessing.
We should just think on that point, you know, the technology now means that we are seeing literally people, you know, with their mobile phones are being able to broadcast around the planet almost instantly. You know, coverage that would have perhaps taken in the early days of your career, you'd have been going out there and then you'd get the film back to London, etc. So that's happening. Whereas now, as you say, Greece might be right on the edge of the current tourist trail. I've got a niece who's going off to Indonesia in a couple of months, and you think, right, that would have been unbelievable. But I think maybe we should let our audience... Ah, Roddy is over here. If anybody has questions for Kate or me, we'd love to have... The lady in the front here.
Hi there. I wanted to ask if there... or what has been the toughest place you've been? Has there ever been a situation where you've thought, oh, I'm not sure if I'm cut out for this, or... don't know if I should have been sent here, and how did you deal with it?
Nobody is cut out for lying in ditches and being shot at, having had a disgusting breakfast and discovered that you've got yet another problem with your intestines. I mean, you know, nobody is cut out for that, is my view in life, certainly not me. When I went off in the First Gulf War with the 48,000 blokes in the British Army and discovered that actually going to war in a desert is an extreme form of camping. And I don't like insects or hard ground. I got 7 months of it. Nobody is cut out for violence, is my view. Nobody with common sense and a decent, you know, outlook in life is cut out to witness it or be offered violence. I had a job, as you did, where your job is... and a privilege is to go there in order to get pictures, sound, and stories to bring it back to other people and show them what's going on. So first of all, you've got actually a job to do. And put it this way as well, if you were a nurse, you don't desire to see people injured or in trouble or very ill, but it is your job. And you get on with it. And if you can make things better or do something positive, that makes it worthwhile. I never had, as it were, a major moment where I said, I really can't face this. I don't think I can do it. Because I would have stopped. Because unless you're positive, you really don't want to crawl out of your sleeping bag somewhere when there's the sound of mortars incoming and extremely drunk people with rifles outside. I mean... you just want to stay there and pretend it's not happening. But you've got to be positive. You've got to say, I've got to do something. I've got to get up there, make sure my folks are safe, get down there, see what pictures we can do, what is going on, ask questions, do the job. So as long as you remain positive and you think it's worthwhile, that gives you the impetus to do it. And I'm a big scaredy cat. Particularly with insects. Big ones.
Yeah, cockroaches do it for me, I have to say. Yeah. But I think sometimes, when you find yourself in a dangerous situation, you've got to keep going, obviously, because otherwise you're just going to end up stuck. I ended up stuck because there were men with guns pointed at me and there was no way out. And it was the most terrifying ordeal, which I then had to cope with, as obviously inside that thing there was no way out, you know, and for years, as it turned out. So one went on another journey, if you like, of self-discovery and coping with the situation, often extremely hard physical conditions and aggressive people holding us at times. I was obviously held with other hostages, but ultimately I think one of the things, just thinking of the title of your autobiography, Kindness of Strangers, whilst these strangers weren't showing us kindness on any level, obviously, it was interesting to discover and recognize that for all that they were holding us hostage, most of the young men, and they were young men, sort of 18, 19, 20 years old when our experience ordeal started, did not choose to abuse us. Yes, they kept us chained up in cells, made us wear blindfolds when they came in, and they always were heavily armed, and kept us remote utterly from the outside world. But for the most part, they didn't seek to abuse us. And I was intrigued by that, because I've now got a little girl who's just 10 years old, and I'm thinking, for these guys, it would be as if suddenly my little Lydia's world went the chaos, the moral depravity of civil war for 10 years. Now, how would she still maintain most of that humanity, which most of these young men did? And I was intrigued by that survived, even though they were turning it against us to a degree. It wasn't willfully brutal. So those are things that one hopes you can learn with. But of course, when, as Kate was saying, somebody is running around, particularly if they're drunk, with a Kalashnikov.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's just, I would think I would have got on the boat home rather than
following. And people don't believe it when we say drunk with a Kalashnikov. A huge majority of the world's conflicts have people who drink heavily, and they're the armed people. Don't think of, you know, disciplined armies, which is what we have in Western Europe, with NATO. We're talking about drunks with Kalashnikovs, and it doesn't matter what their religion says either about alcohol. They just can't handle it as well. Yeah. And drunks with Kalashnikovs means there's no negotiation. There's no reasoning, and it's very frightening. Yeah. And hugely so. I mean, Chechnya was just a permanent bar with no closing time. Like very, very frightening things like that. And time and again people say, can you intervene? Can you do that? And the argument is, once they've got a gun and they say that, that's it. You don't start arguing and saying, we don't do this in Tunbridge Wells. You know? Doesn't work. Have we any more questions? Yes, we've got one at the back there, and another one over there. Right back.
Oh, sorry. I'm making my way out to the suburbs.
He moves very well, that boy. Look at him. Right the way through the gentleman in yellow there.
Sorry, I'm there.
Hi, John, this is more a question for you. What do you make of the expression Stockholm Syndrome? Do you go with that?
Stockholm Syndrome, yes, I do know that expression. And that's, you know, the idea that if you're held hostage by an individual or a group, you can come to identify with their aspirations, their aims, their whatever, their political motives or social motives, whatever they may be. I recognize the term, but I don't recognize it has happened to me or those people, other hostages I was held with in Lebanon. And I, thinking of recently of the great TV series, I say great in terms of being successful, Homeland, or indeed the Israeli series that it was based on, which was Prisoners of War, I think, where prisoners have been held a long time by the enemy, if you like, and they've turned, some of them anyway. It's good drama, perhaps, and entertainment, but I don't know that many people would suffer or fall, if you like, for Stockholm Syndrome. As I was just saying, I began to recognize the humanity of the people holding us hostage, and could see and was determined to recognize them as human beings. But that didn't mean that I in any way accepted them, not necessarily their motives. Their aspirations might have been just for a better world, if you like, a better slice of the cake indeed for their community within Lebanon. However, I didn't obviously accept the way they were going about that, that they couldn't justify to me, well, you know, we've got to fight our war and this is it. That was their excuse, and I could understand it, but I didn't in any way accept the way they were going about it, or indeed really that idea that beyond one or two individuals, perhaps, one would begin to think, oh yes, I completely agree with you, yes, you're right, and I see that happening. Perhaps on longer term people might become convinced, but you know, 5 years was quite long, and it didn't get me in that way. Thank you.
We had another one, a hand over there.
Thank you. Can I ask you both, you've obviously seen the worst and the best of people, perhaps, in the course of your careers. What's it like to come home from, in your case, captivity, John, and Kate, from these dreadful situations that you've been in, and see what people are preoccupied with when you get back home? How easy is it to adjust to that?
Well, coming back from a war zone, how does it feel to see us being obsessed with whatever we are in the UK?
Yeah, the first thing, actually, I do remember this very clearly, 3.5 years going in and out of Sarajevo by hook or by crook, sometimes driving through for sort of 16 hours through logging trails, getting shot at and spending the night in the ditch and getting covered with God knows what. And you know, you got out, and or else you got you managed to hitch a ride on one of the aid planes. On one specific thing, I remember having spent 4 weeks in Sarajevo where there was no electricity, no running water, no nothing, etc., and we're eating disgusting, you know, what there was in the way of food we could barter. And I got out and I found myself in Vienna Airport. And we were this little group, you know, in the corner, knackered, waiting for the connection to London. And we had flak jackets and we sort of jeans and the boots we were stood up in, you know, and a helmet home there and backpacks and things. And I kept thinking, you know, I wonder if people are noticing us. And now I looked around the airport and I noticed there was a large gap between us and them. Everybody else in Pratchett had moved. We stank. That's what it's like. That's the first thing you come past. You realize you really have lived in a very different situation. And the other thing is, you become very fond of incredibly pedestrian things. Mm. This is going to sound very bizarre, but I have a measure of what I call civilized life is working. You're not going to believe this one. If you go out of this building now, there will, I can guarantee you, be a pavement with curbstones. We have granite curbstones in this. It's a really nerdy thing. And they are curbstones because if a bus or a lorry hits them, they don't crumble. They are granite, good Scottish granite. We have them throughout this country. You've never noticed it because you're people looking above at the wonderful world, right? You look at the curbstones. I don't really know anywhere outside of Europe, and even some European countries, who have nice, neat pavements that don't fray, crumble, and collapse after 3 months. Every single rich Arab state has crummy pavements, partly because they don't like walking.
That's true, that's true.
But it's a tiny little sort of touch which says, we have... In every local authority, there's a bloke who cares about curbstones. But it's a tiny thing about how complex and how much our society does actually function.
Yeah.
And does these tiny details. There you are, nerd of the year, curbstones.
I think when I came back, there was I was amazed everybody was preoccupied with clothes, although I realised I was. I hadn't been, you know, just been given T-shirts and shorts for 5 years and a tracksuit in the winter. But I was suddenly getting very vain again when I was allowed to choose clothes, and I realised that. I was fascinated by the fact that I came home in 1991, so there'd been the massive building boom and then the bust of the late 80s in the UK. So there were all these huge office blocks and stuff with to let written all over them. I thought, why have people gone mad and built all these things that they didn't need? And I was getting back in the idea of speculation and people wanting to own things and stuff. So it was very strange, really, coming back. But I think what I was thinking about, why are we all obsessed with such things when mostly, particularly as I was moving back into this city, into London, we're all free to move around and stuff. You know, we've become all these things that we're not. We need to have this, we need to have that, the new car, the new flat, the new clothes. But actually, all we need is to be able to walk up and down blooming Oxford Street and look at those things, and we're in paradise already, really. You know.
But if you're in the countryside, and you realise that there isn't the sound of gunfire over the hills, which is one of the things I've heard in countless landscapes, which are beautiful. And it's this sort of boom, and, you know, curious rattling sort of sound of AKs and things in the distance. And you've still got this wonderful landscape in these places like Sri Lanka and Lebanon and Bosnia and so many other places. Very, very beautiful. And you realize we don't have gunfire. And then there's the freedom. And I hold this dear. I campaign furiously, I mean, if I'd have to in this country, about our freedom to walk around without being asked questions. I really, truly hate the terrorism which makes the more officious people in safe countries think we ought to be checked. We ought to show ID. We ought to have everything searched. Where are you going? Mm-hmm. Freedom means freedom to trust each other, even though there may be ghastly, evil, vicious-minded people who every so often slip through the net and cause terrible things. Freedom is freedom to be us and go to walk abroad. And I think it's a wonderful thing in this country. I used to just like, after coming back from some places, just going out the front door and saying, I don't have to duck. It's marvellous. And there are far too many places in the world where this is the case.
That's right. We are very lucky.
Yeah.
And I'd be very lucky to share a stage with you, Kate. I think we have to finish, but thank you all very much for joining us here this morning. Thank you, this afternoon.